This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There was a moment of sweetness in sorrow last night as President Bush used the first words of his State of the Union address to mark the death of civil rights icon Coretta Scott King. And then it was all business. Fire and brimstone for radical Islam, for Iran and its nuclear ambitions, for Hamas on its election victory. A nod toward political harmony in America, then in knuckle-wrapping for isolationists and defeatists. George W. Bush has 3 years to go in the White House and not a lot of running room between big deficits and Iraq War. It's a tough spot, and the president looked again last night to make a virtue of toughness. Up next on Point, parsing the president's State of the Union. In a moment, we'll be joined by former White House insiders David Gergen and Gene Sperling, and later in this hour by Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley. But we begin in Washington. Ann Kornblut is national reporter for The New York Times. She was on Capitol Hill last night and joins me now. Ann, thanks for being with us. You were in the chamber. Tell us about the atmosphere there.
Well, I mean, as always, there was a lot of pageantry and theater. You know, when the president came in, there were certain Democrats who sat down with their arms folded while Republicans wildly cheered. For once, the Democrats really seemed to have a couple of openings in the sort of theatrical booing. The president stated out loud that Congress had failed to act on the Social Security plan last year, and the Democrats took that opportunity to cheer and to interrupt his speech. But beyond that, there really was nothing sort of out of the ordinary. One note is that Cindy Sheehan, the war protest mom, of course, from last summer, had made her way into the event. She'd been given a ticket, but she was arrested because she planned to unfurl a poster, so she was taken out. So we didn't have that little bit of drama during the speech itself.
So Justice Alito in the chamber, Cindy Sheehan not.
Yes.
And the president at the rostrum, how's Washington digesting the president's message today? How's it going down, Ann?
Well, I think everybody has agreed that it was a toned-down message. There was plenty of soaring rhetoric, of course, but there was a degree of humility to it and an acknowledgement that of all of the challenges that he faces. I mean, he made a reference, of course, to saying the word Abramoff to the lobbying scandals that have rocked the Republican Party. He obviously acknowledged Social Security hadn't worked. He was fairly muted on Iran, and although he tried to sound tough on the Palestinians on Hamas, he didn't really go into it at length. So I think that the baseline is that he was really still soaring, but fundamentally humbler than he was a year earlier.
And there, before the speech, there was the heads up that there was going to be, might very well be, some outreach to the Democrats here, reaching across the party line, a kind of tempering note on the very bitter partisan politics that have come to take over Washington. Was there anything in the president's speech substantially last night that might be fairly called outreach?
Well, that's obviously subjective. Democrats didn't emerge saying that they felt he had done that way. The Democrats I talked to afterwards said that it was just more Bush doublespeak, and they behaved during the speech as though he were riling them up. And there were moments in the speech, particularly, as you mentioned in your introduction, when he talked about the war, saying that repeating his line that critics of the war were being unpatriotic. So I would say that even if that was their intent, Democrats are in no mood to accept anything he says right now as bipartisan.
George Bush has 3 years to go. He clearly felt, I think, sort of constrained by budget constraints as he looked out last night, by the cost and duration of the war in Iraq. It's a big project the country has taken on. Were there programs outlined here of real scale and substance?
Well, I mean, again, I think members of both parties would say no. Then again, there rarely are. Sometimes there are big goals set, and even in that sense, the president didn't sort of scale back his ambitions this year. But that's actually not that out of the usual. The one line that you always hear in a State of the Union address, and we heard it last night, was the state of our union is strong. And that's the message that he intended to send, and he did.
Strong, lots of headwinds, and the president positioning himself as standing tough in the face of them. Ann Kornblut, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ann Kornblut, national reporter for The New York Times. She spoke with me from Washington. Joining me now in the studio is consummate White House insider David Gergen. He served as advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's professor of public service and the director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. David Gergen, great to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Washington is Gene Sperling. From 1996 to 2000, he was President Bill Clinton's economic advisor and head of the National Economic Council. He was economic advisor to John Kerry in his presidential run and is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Gene Sperling, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Later in this hour, we'll be joined by Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley. But David Gergen, let me come first to you. The president's speech last night, not exactly super soaring rhetoric here, a more straightforward speech.
Indeed. It was a well-constructed speech, vigorously delivered, but one that ultimately, I think, did not change the political landscape very much. Indeed, I would argue that we had three major events in Washington yesterday: the confirmation of Judge Alito, the farewell of Alan Greenspan, and the President's State of the Union address. And history will look back and say the least significant was the address.
Do you see, David Gergen, an evolution in the tone, the message, the worldview of George Bush here, or is it back to basics, Bush basics?
I saw no evolution in worldview, especially on the international front. I thought he was as tough as he has been in the past. Perhaps he didn't rattle the sabers in quite the same way. But I didn't see any change. I think the most important thing about this president is how resolute he is. And for his supporters, of course, that is welcome, because I think there's been too much wavering in the White House in recent years. But if you were Iranian, you wouldn't take any comfort out of that speech. If you were in the Iranian government, if you were among those at Hamas, you wouldn't take any comfort out of that speech last night. There were no bouquets or
none intended.
No, none intended. He's plowing straight ahead, for better or for worse. On the domestic front, there was some change in tone. There, you could say, well, he went a little bit to the middle on some things. But, you know, more than anything else, I thought there was a postponement of serious national issues. Last year, we had at least a proposal on the table that he put forward. I know Gene Sperling objects to it, but at least it was a proposal to move forward on Social Security. This time, we're back to a commission. We tried a commission once, and I think a commission under this president's watch, with 3 years left to go, guarantees you won't have a report for a year and a half, 2 years. Mm-hmm. You'll be into the final year of the presidency. That means the can has been kicked down the road to the next president.
Is this a kind of rope-a-dope by the president, sort of,
Well, it's
playing out the fight.
I'm sure Gene can help me with this, mm-hmm. but it's like the patriotism being the last refuge of a scoundrel. You know, commissions are the last refuges of presidents. Don't know quite what to do.
Gene Sperling, David Gergen says no comfort here for Iran, for the Palestinians, and right on down the line. Any comfort for Democrats here? The president said we must not allow our differences to harden into anger, but then went quickly to calling his critics, at least it seemed broad stroke, defeatists and isolationists. Is that a new framing? Is he looking to box the Democrats into those containers?
Well, I think the most important thing is that if you want to change the bipartisanship or have more bipartisanship in Washington, you can't do it just with some tactical rhetoric in the State of the Union. That might work with a few folks in the media, a few folks at home. But I think for Democrats, they're looking to see, is this the real deal? And the real deal is reaching out to people and being willing to compromise on the big issues that actually force people to come to the table. And we have seen that in the past. We saw that with Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill on Social Security in 1983. We saw it with the older President Bush and Speaker Foley in 1990, and we saw it with President Clinton and his nemesis, Speaker Gingrich, in 97. But there were real signals sent out. There was a real signal sent out. We might go along with some of your capital gains tax cuts and things we have strongly opposed if you're willing to help us balance the budget, increase health care for children, et cetera. So I think that's why you're not seeing Democrats caring too much, that there was a little bit nicer language. I thought what was most distinctive on the economic and domestic front was how defensive the speech was. Let's think about this. Last year, what were the big issues? The three big ones were partially privatizing Social Security, tax reform, and the ownership society. He didn't mention a word about his three self-announced major initiatives. And the one thing he did do was start to respond to the Democrats, who've been saying for years now, looking at the competitive challenge from India and China, on science, education. You know, whether his initiative is going to be a real deal or just, you know, PR, that's too early to tell now. But it was a much more defensive State of the Union. Someone said to me it was the do no harm to Republican candidates running in 2006. Take no risks at all.
The president last night talked again about the U.S. taking a big role in the world in foreign policy and described anything else, more or less, as isolationism. Let's listen.
In a complex and challenging time, the road of isolationism and protectionism may seem broad and inviting, yet it ends in danger and decline. The only way to protect our people, the only way to secure the peace, the only way to control our destiny is by our leadership, so the United States of America will continue to lead.
David Gergen, a straw man or a real criticism here? The president kind of setting up this black and white, kind of you're with me or you're an isolationist, you're with me on the economy or you're a protectionist. Do you hear voices in America today, prominent voices of isolationism and protectionism?
I was surprised by that that argument, that the choice is isolationism and protectionism versus my strong leadership, because, frankly, I have not heard, you know, come home, America, in this war, as we heard in the Vietnam War from the left. The response, the Democratic response, which came from Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia, was we're not arguing isolationism, protectionism. We're arguing whether you've made bad choices and managed this and made bad management decisions along the way. So it seems to me the Democrats did join that argument last night, and for one of the first times, the Democrats have not, and all of us have not found their voice. And Tim Kaine, soft-spoken as he was, as much of a newcomer as he was surprisingly effective in the Democratic response. Rare that happens. But what the Democrats have not done is advance an alternative agenda, whether it's in health care or education or in energy and indeed on dealing with Iraq and Iran. One of the few people on the Democratic side who has done so is Gene Sperling, who's written a book, quite a good book, and one that I would commend to you as being the beginnings of what the Democratic, the left, or the progressive side of the country could argue.
He is the pro-growth progressive.
Yes, exactly.
I want to turn to Washington right now, if I may. Gene, David Gergen, please stand by. We're joined by Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa. Senator Grassley, thanks very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be with you, and I apologize to your stars that you have on there that I didn't hear everything they said, but I'm proud to be on with a couple outstanding public people like they.
We'll trust that you'll be eminently worth hearing from in spite of that, Senator Grassley. You're chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, also the Budget and Agriculture Committees. But you've been very outspoken about the fiscal issues facing the country. Did you see the president picking that challenge up adequately last night? Was he on top of the spending issue?
Well, he's on top of it as far as being a good presidential leader is concerned, as getting the national or the annual deficit down below 2.5% of gross national product, and the national debt keeping it under 40% of gross national product. But for the average American, when they read a $300 billion deficit, it only spells fiscal irresponsibility, whether you're Republican or Democrat, regardless of how responsible that debt might be, even more responsible than what Reagan had in 1982. So from that standpoint of really setting the stage, he did it in an intellectual way, but not necessarily in a way that makes sense to the average American. But that's tough for any president to do.
Senator Grassley, are you saying that the deficit is not as big a problem as people might think, that if you just work the numbers right, it looks A-okay?
Well, no deficit is okay if you're looking at the responsibility we have to our children and grandchildren. But from the standpoint of comparison deficit with what Reagan had in 1982 or even what Clinton had in 1993, as a percentage of gross national product, we are in the same ballpark or a better ballpark than they were. But to the average American, Mary Smith and John Jones out there in grassroots of America, a $300 billion deficit is irresponsible spending. And I admit that there's irresponsible spending within that budget, But there's still a lot within the budget that must be done, particularly when you're trying to defend American citizens with the number one responsibility of the federal government, which is to give them national security, and we are in a war on terror.
Senator, what did you make of the president's speech overall? He used to joke during the reelection campaign that he would quack like a duck in his second term, a kind of lame duck joke, the kind George Bush likes privately. Did you see him with lame duck aura last night? Did you see him leading?
He's obviously leading, because that's a presidential power is that big, depending upon the individual. You're a leader, more or less. And I think this president is more leader than less of a leader. But on the other hand, don't forget that if he's just a little bit laid back in his offerings for the next year or the next 3 years, he is also giving Congress an opportunity to catch up from the very ambitious programs he put forth in his first term and last year. And we're not very good in catching up.
Mm. Senator Grassley, Republican of Iowa, thank you very much for being with us.
God bless you.
I want to turn to Elizabeth, calling from South Riding, Virginia. Hi, Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to call and let you know that I am extremely optimistic and rather delighted to hear President Bush, a big oil man from Texas with lots of oil buddies, speaking directly to the use of renewable energy sources, whether it is solar, wind, ethanol, or other alternate fuels. America must pursue these energy options to reduce foreign oil dependence, and I was very happy to hear the president talk about it during the State of the Union last night.
There it was, and kind of a new theme for this president, at least in that specificity and that way of framing it. Elizabeth, thanks for that. Gene Sperling, what about it? The president says Americans are addicted to oil. This doesn't sound like the Texas oil man who first came into office.
Well, I would say that was probably his best line in the speech. He obviously has always faced a negative perception about being beholden to the energy industry. You have the Enron trial, his good friends, under trial now. You have a lot of special interest pork. So I think it was smart for him to try to distance himself. But I think this is one of these issues where the proof will be in the pudding. It's good to set good goals, but I think, as you saw, most of the commentary today said, essentially, where's the beef? Where is the actual tough policy that is going to really push us towards less reliance on oil? And I think that there's a lot of skepticism. Jonathan Weissman said in the Washington Post today that when you look at the energy initiatives behind them, they're actually quite small bore. His energy research initiatives have generally been down over the last couple of years. He's offering very small amounts. So I think it was his best rhetorical line, but I think that there's an enormous amount of skepticism whether this president, with his orientation and his record, really is committed to doing something bold in this area.
David Gergen, what about it? Is the president talking big and acting small here? Or when an American president says America is addicted to oil and we've got to get off it, is that the beginning of turning the ship of state?
There is no indication that we're really going to turn. Listen, we've been hearing for 35 years from American presidents, and the first president I worked for was Richard Nixon. I was there in 1971 when he called for independence and energy, and at that time we were about 40% dependent on foreign oil. We're now over 60% dependent. We've had subsequent presidents, Nixon, Carter, and others who've all done this, and you have, if you're going to take this seriously, you have to come in with serious proposals. These are good things on alternative energy, but you know, they're way down the road. There is nothing here that demands sacrifice. There's nothing here that's courageous in the sense of saying, if you really want to deal with the energy problem and get us off this addiction to oil, put on a gasoline tax and then use those funds to help balance the budget and do a few of the things you need to do on the domestic side to help people. If you're really serious about this, you know, recognize global warming for the danger that it is. There was no mention in the speech last night about global warming.
True.
There is no sense of urgency, and scientists are beginning to say now the real question about global warming is not whether it's happening, but when does it become irreversible? And if we wait 20, 25 years to begin making progress on this energy issue, we're going to find ourselves not only further addicted to oil, further, you know, over the barrel to these international countries like Iran, but, you know, in a deeply dangerous situation to the globe.
The voice of a man who's watched this can get kicked around through Nixon and Ford and Reagan and Clinton. Of course, the president calling last night for the country by 2025 to replace 75% of its Mideast oil imports Oil people saying today, well, fine, but only 20% of our oil comes from the Mideast.
Oil is fungible, and you know, as in all these issues, as in education reform, as on health care reform, it's nice to have the rhetoric, the reassuring rhetoric. But we as a country, on neither party, are taking these issues as seriously as we might and approaching them and saying, you know what, the next generation is really going to pay a price if we don't deal with this. The next generation is going to find its standard of living going down, its capacity to live longer going down. The next generation may be the first one in American history whose standard of living is lower than the previous generation, and the first one who would live a shorter period of time, and the first one who could face potential catastrophe on the global warming side.
There's a big hello. President talked a lot about last night about competitiveness and American readiness to compete in a world where China and India are coming up. Let's listen to a bit on education and the American economy here as the president brought that out front and center, kind of a new theme for this president at this depth.
We must continue to lead the world in human talent and creativity. Our greatest advantage in the world has always been our educated, hardworking, ambitious people, and we're going to keep that edge. Tonight, I announced an American Competitiveness Initiative to encourage innovation throughout our economy and to give our nation's children a firm grounding in math and science.
David Gergen, step after step, at least rhetorically outlined last night by the president, acknowledging the challenge of China and India by name, talking about American competitiveness in more depth, they sort of harkened back to my ear to the Bill Clinton kind of message.
Well, in this area, I believe the president does deserve a great credit for grasping this issue finally. And while the Democrats have been saying things, I think the president has really taken the lead now from them. We had a report from the National Academies of Science a few months ago that saying, look, this challenge from China and India and the other Asian nations is serious, and we really have to reform our schools and improve the quality of our science and math teaching so that we have far more Americans prepared to go into the world of work and become scientists and technicians and the like. And here the president has embraced these recommendations, some of the recommendations of the National Academies. And I think he deserves credit for that. It's important. The country has been asleep to the larger long-term challenge that faces the next generation if we don't prepare them to compete against this rising tide of well-trained Chinese and Indian. We're going to see a decline in our standard of living. So I was delighted that he said, look, let's get 70,000 new teachers and teaching rigorously in a math and science area. He did not embrace the idea of offering far more scholarships to people to go to college. I wish we'd seen more of that, to go to college in math and science. That would have been helpful. Mm-hmm. But what he is trying to do is get companies to take their retirees and put them out into the high schools and prep schools and other urban schools to help. And that's beginning to happen, by the way. IBM is now turning out, I think, 100 a year or so of their retirees and sending them into the schools. We need far bigger effort in that. And I think there are times we criticize the president, but on this one, I think he deserves praise for grasping the issue.
At least it's back in the presidential language. I mean, just raising it raises the invitation to act, as calling oil an addiction raises an invitation to act, even if if the program isn't right there.
Absolutely. It does point us down the right path. I would argue it doesn't go far enough down the path, but nonetheless, at least we see the path. And that has not been true from this White House. This is a White House which has, frankly, not been very sympathetic to issues of science, especially on global warming.
Let's hear the president last night on wiretapping. It's been a big issue in recent weeks in Washington. He spoke last night. He did not call it domestic wiretapping, as the president does. He called it terrorist surveillance program. Here's the president.
The terrorist surveillance program has helped prevent terrorist attacks. It remains essential to the security of America. If there are people inside our country who are talking with al-Qaeda, we want to know about it, because we will not sit back and wait to be hit again.
Gene Sperling, here's national security, not economics. But what do you hear, though? The president's renaming it. It's a terrorist surveillance program, not a domestic spying program. And if they're calling, we want to hear.
This is where, of course, why Democrats probably didn't take the olive branch all that seriously. Here you have the ultimate straw man. If you are concerned about the president overreaching the law, his constitutional powers, he's put you on the side of being somebody who wants to sit back and wait to be hit again. That is not the type of way you build particular bipartisan support. I'd also like to respond to the, you know, agree with something the previous viewer was saying, and maybe take a slight disagreement or be slightly less generous than David Gergen was. Budgets are about priorities and values. Yes, it's nice that the president finally mentioned science, the competitive threat. He really had to. Nancy Pelosi, Democratic leaders have an innovation agenda out. The public is feeling that. But let's look at what's actually happened. National Institute of Health is actually going to have a lower budget this year than it did 3 years ago. Scientists are laying people off in their labs as we speak. And part of the reason that it's going to be so difficult for the president to live up to his rhetoric is he is stuck in this ideological view where things like the estate tax have to stay on his agenda. Now, consider this. In the next decade, it will probably cost us $60, $70 billion a year just to repeal the estate tax for maybe 10, 15,000 estates. The president talked about spending a few billion more in National Science Foundation, which I'm all for. But is that really the priorities? So I think that as long as the president is going to say, first and foremost, we're about permanent tax cuts, even for the well-off, even for the $100 billion a year we could save by not extending it for the well-off, then he's going to put himself in a box. Look at the box he did yesterday. I want to increase science funding, but I'm going to lower that part of the budget. It puts us in a box where we're going to be robbing Peter to pay Paul. I think that the president is going to be serious. He's got to be willing to look at the whole fiscal situation and ask, as I think this caller did, why would we spend $50 to $70 billion a year to give 10,000 of the richest estates tax relief, but we only have a few billion a year to do something major on science and competitiveness? I think we have out-of-whack priorities. And, you know, David Gergen did make the point that Tony Blair has done well. And Mr. Grassley tried to say, well, the deficits aren't as bad as they were in Ronald Reagan's worst year. But let's look at our shores. In the 1990s, President Clinton helped lead a fiscal discipline revolution that did include higher taxes on the most well-off. We had a tremendous economy, the record expansion, and we had surpluses when President Bush came in. And the reason why it's better, more important to have fiscal discipline now than 20 years ago is because we are on the brink of the baby boom retirement challenge.
And the president spoke to that last night. He spoke directly to it.
He spoke to it, but when his
dad's two best friends are turning 60, himself and Bill Clinton.
But, you know, you can talk the talk and you can walk the walk. And if your only goal is to not be worse than Ronald Reagan's worst year on the deficit, that's not exactly leading the nation forward in fiscal responsibility.
David Gergen, let me turn this just a little bit, if I may, thematically. Here's Gene Sperling, doesn't like the tax cuts, doesn't want to see more. We heard you say something similar already. But at some large level, the president last night is describing a world, maybe a century, that's not going to be easy. It's going to be tough. There are these big environmental challenges. There are big security challenges. There are big competitiveness challenges. Gene Sperling may not like his prescriptions. You may not be satisfied with them. But is there something here in the president saying, Americans, toughen up? Be tough. This is going to be a tough time. Or is that a way of ducking?
I think there's a recognition rhetorically that we're facing bigger and bigger issues, but the response is not preparing us to meet them in time. These issues are coming at us faster than we're getting ready to prepare for them. It's like leaving, you know, when you think about where we are in New Orleans after Katrina, you know, there are 170 miles now of areas where the levees have not been fully repaired. We're 5 months away from a new hurricane season. That's a metaphor for what's happening to the country in all of these areas, whether it be global warming or education or competitiveness. We can talk rhetorically as if there are big storms coming, but are we preparing ourselves in time? And it's one of the big issues hanging over us now as a democracy is, can we bring ourselves together and do the important things in a bipartisan way, as Gene urges, that really looks after the next generation. And I think that's one of the critical challenges, and it's a moral challenge for the older generation now to get beyond the rhetoric and see if we can be serious about preparing ourselves and dealing with these issues before the storm hits.
But how do you read this president's psychology, this president's worldview then? He's calling for toughness. Toughness is
He's
part of what it will take.
He's not calling for toughness. If there's
well,
no,
he is
there's
in
no,
his words.
Well, but there's no sacrifice here. There is no – there's nobody having to belly up and say, you know, I think I'm going to give up my tax cuts. There's nobody having to say, I think I'll pay extra 50 cents a gallon or a dollar a gallon.
What's the why? Why wouldn't he then push forward more ambitiously? How do you read him as a leader,
a
political
worldview?
I think
both parties are so addicted to winning office and pleasing the public and essentially this is this quality we're pandering and saying to people, you know, we got to get ready, but we're not going to ask you to do anything that's going to be really, really hard to do. We're not making the painful choices. And there are big, big painful choices to be made here. You can't pass a prescription drugs program, which has huge amount of money in it, and by the way, it's not well administered, and expect then to not have a problem on the deficit. Mm. You can't say, we're going to, you know, get rid of the estate tax, we're going to make these tax cuts permanent, and then have anything left. I think, you know, Bill Clinton used to argue when he came into office and faced these deficits, he said the deficits were a bone in his throat, the bone in the throat of the country. Until you got rid of the deficits, you couldn't do much else. And that's increasingly our problem now. You can't put the kind of resources in, as Gene has been arguing, to deal with some of these issues unless you do come to grips with this.
But give us a historical sense here. You advised Nixon and Ford and Reagan. How would they look at what's going on with this Republican president, their heir in some respect?
Listen, I think that they would salute him for his toughness in foreign policy and taking on the Iraqis. I think that is part of the Republican tradition, to be very hard-nosed on the foreign policy side. But let's go back to Ronald Reagan. He started out by cutting taxes early on, and then he recognized that the cuts had gone too deeply compared to the cuts in spending, and we had an imbalance, and we had to deal with it. He signed seven different tax increases. Ronald Reagan signed seven different tax increases during the subsequent years of his presidency. Mm-hmm. Now, the people like Richard Darman, who were his advisors and helped to persuade him, became anathema within the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. I think unfairly, but you know he was willing to do it. George H.W. Bush, having made the pledge.
Read my lips.
He came back because he thought it was the right thing to do for the country. And there is, you know, there is this classic question that always runs through literature about when does being resolute as a leader become stubbornness and refusing to face the realities. I mean, this goes all the way back to Antigone and the questions that the king faced. Once you lay down an order, if you have to stick to it, sometimes stubbornly, you wind up paying a huge price, and I think there's a growing sense among moderates in the Republican Party as well among Democrats that it's time to change course from the course we're on and take these issues more seriously.
The Antigone angle, and with half a minute, the president on Iraq, he said we got to stay the course. Does the president have a choice here?
To say last night, I will accept a constructive criticism from the Congress on Iraq, but there'll be no second guessing. I mean, my goodness, that is legitimate. Second guessing, there is good reason to have some questions about how we got into this and what mistakes were made and why are people, we don't have enough armor and all the rest. So it seems to me that is a dismissive response on the president's part.
But there's the State of the Union as this president sees it.
This is complex stuff, isn't it?
It sure is. David Gergen, we're out of time. Thanks so much for being with us. Gene Sperling, author of The Pro-Growth Progressive, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.